Good evening, everyone, and thank you for listening to Lakeshore Public Radio on the dial at 89.1 FM and streaming worldwide wherever you may be at lakeshorepublicradio.org. It's time for Midwest Beat, a program all about music and the people who make it. I'm your host, Tom Lounges, and tonight, for the next hour, we're going to be steeped in the blues. Curtis Salgado, a great vocalist, songwriter, instrumentalist, has got a brand new album on Alligator Records, one of my favorite labels in the world. Damage Control is the name of the album. He's an inspired and soulful performer. I'm sure he's got some great stories to share. We're going to have Curtis on the phone, and we're going to feature songs from Damage Control. It's all coming up after your headline, so be sure to stay here with us as we take a bite out of the blues with Alligator Records. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for listening to Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Tom Lounges, and you are on the dial at 89.1 FM. Or perhaps you're streaming with us, wherever you may be. Thank you for tuning in online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This show is all about music and the people who make it, and often we feature the blues here because I am a hardcore blues fan, and one of my favorite labels is Alligator Records. Why? Because they have some of the best artists in the world. Indeed they do. And we're going to meet one of them tonight. Curtis Salgado has a new album on Alligator called Damage Control. He's got some great stories to share, I'm sure. He's rubbed elbows over the years with, Carlos Santana, Robert Cray, and I'm sure there's a good story in there about John Belushi we'll try to get him to share as well. But mostly, we're going to listen to this great new album, Damage Control. It came out at the end of last year, or actually the beginning of this year, in 2021. So let's play the title track right now, and let's get Curtis on the phone. This is Damage Control, Curtis Salgado from Alligator Records.
Day just beginning, another day that will soon end, and all that takes place in between is what you call this life, my friend. We never asked to be here, oh no, we didn't have a choice. Opinion, 'cause we didn't have no voice, just trying to carry on and take it easy, slow your breathing, keep your head up, stay down low, and deal with this damage control. They say we're flirting with disaster, so say the news and they're talking heads. That's everyday operating procedure. Let's call it what it really is instead. Never asked for special treatment and hardly ever stepped out of line. Now it's kid gloves on and bite your tongue and think before you speak your mind. So just try to carry on, take it easy, slow your breathing, yeah. Oh, keep your head up, stay down low, and deal with this damage control. Sometimes I think it's all a big mistake. Someone upstairs just fell asleep. I don't know about any of that, but I know, I know, I know it wasn't up to me. question the cosmic design, the professors and the doctors and the next Einstein. They'll never find the answer cause they don't know. So I'll just try to carry on and do my damage control. I never asked to be here, whoa, no. I didn't have no choice, just long for the ride. Yeah, don't you know, try to stay out of trouble, yeah. Just trying to carry on and deal with this damage control.
Doing a little damage control on Midwest Beat here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Tom Lounges. That is new music from Curtis Salgado. That's his 11th career album, his fourth for my favorite blues label in the world, Bruce Iglauer's Alligator Records. And I got to say, I'm excited to have this gentleman join us. My first time speaking with him, certainly not my first time listening to his music. Curtis, are you with us?
I am here, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Got to say, this is a really great album. I'm enjoying it so much, and I'm glad it's finally out. I know it was scheduled at the end of 2020, but like so many things, got delayed, and we just got it out a couple of weeks ago. So congrats on a great new product.
Thank you very much, sir. Very nice. Thank you.
Now, this album was recorded over three different studios with a variety of guest players. Why the road work on this? Why the travelogue in making this record?
Well, you know, in my brain, thank you, Tom. In my head, I thought two reasons. First of all, I wanted to make a rock and roll record. And to me, just kind of like a template. And so I started writing. I'm always writing songs because that's how I make a living, is, you know, it's record tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started writing this particular record in 2017. And I had some already songs and ideas from, you know, one from the 1990s and stuff that I always wanted to do. Anyhow, to answer your question, is I thought, you know, I want to do it with three different rhythm sections. And what if I picked, the reason was, instead of 12 songs with the same band on all 12 songs and the same stuff, you know, you add sweetening at the end or horns or this. I just wanted it somewhat sort of stripped down, just three different rhythm sections. And then the other reason is it's something to give the media to talk about.
Okay.
because if you don't, you know, they, you know, you can't, you always have to come out with a product, or you don't get hired at festivals and you don't get hired on the road. I mean, they go, we've already talked about your last record. Do you have anything new? And if you say no, they go, well, we'll hire you the next time you get a record out.
Right.
And that's the truth. You have to keep, you got to keep yourself up there. You got to, you have to keep yourself going and in the news and in the media. And so I thought this would be something, you know, that's kind of like two birds, one stone kind of a thing.
Okay.
And, yeah, so it's like give the media something to talk about. And secondly, I know all these wonderful musicians, and I wouldn't have been able to pull this off if it wasn't for those guys. You know, it's just like I brought five songs to Nashville, four songs to San Jose at Greaseland Studios, and four songs to L.A. at Ultratone Studios. And all the musicians are more than acquaintances. We play together, you know, and I know who they are and what they can achieve.
Damage Control. Damage Control, the title track we just played. Which studio was that from?
That is from L.A.
Okay.
And the music is, have you ever heard of Michael Finnegan?
Yes.
Well, you know, Michael is like on Jimi Hendrix records.
Right.
He's on Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and he's on, you know, on and on and on. Bonnie Raitt, Joe Cocker. And I mean, the huge laundry list of great musicians and great stars. Michael Finnegan came up with the music about 4 years ago. He played it for me, and I was at his house, and I recorded it on my phone. And he's just the very first, that minor thing, the very top of it. Mm-hmm. That's all he had. I recorded it. Then when I started in 2018, I flew to his house. I said, let's finish this song. And we got together and did the verse part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the day is just beginning. That's the verses, right? And I took the music and had the bones of it. And then I started writing the lyrics. And I wrote the lyrics down with a young man by the name of Ryan Waters, who is actually in the Prince camp for the last 5 years of his life.
Hmm.
And Ryan is a young man that's from Salem, Oregon. He used to play with Pink. And he used to play with Sade. And then he ended up in the Prince camp. But he's brilliant. And so he wrote the words, another day is just beginning, another day will soon end, and all that comes in between is what you call this life, my friend. And then I wrote the next part. And I started writing the verses and took a few more lines from him. So he launched it, and then I just finished it up, you know.
Wow. That song.
Coming upstairs. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you, sir.
That song reminds me in some ways of Dr. John. The piano, the vocal that you give it. Your voice is different on different tracks. I like that. That one track does not necessarily bleed into the other and say, oh, it's the same band, same guy. So I see what you were saying about going to different studios and getting a different feel and a different vibe. You succeeded in that. One of the things that's interesting to this album, to my ears, is that you're from Oregon. Cut your chops in Chicago, hanging out and listening to the you know, Paul Butterfield and Michael Bloomfield lineup, a Little Walter, some of the Chess guys, and you have a strong New Orleans groove, not just the Dr. John Cajun kind of groove on that, but also Truth Be Told, a great song on this album we're going to get to. That's got a Zydeco feel. You're all over the map, but in a good way, not disoriented way, but very cohesive, the way you kind of bring us all through these different textures. Is that the goal with this?
Well, I mean, it's where I'm from. I'm from Portland, Eugene, Oregon is where I'm from. And when I grew up, I'll be real quick, you know, my parents were jazz enthusiasts. And then I have an older brother, older sister, and they were hip as well. And so I grew up listening to Count Basie, Jimmy Lunsford, Anita O'Day, Gene Krupa. You know, my brother brought home Live at Jazz at Massey Hall with Charlie Parker and Bud Powell. And so, I mean, I am very much knowledgeable in jazz and blues and soul and this. And when I was a kid, that's what hit me, man. I wanted to know the history and why. I learned about America and I learned about racism through this music. You know, mm-hmm. they didn't let Count Basie in the front door of Carnegie Hall. And I read about that when I was a kid listening to Benny Goodman live at Carnegie Hall in 1938. That's a mark moment, you know, with Sing, Sing, Sing and Count Basie and with the Benny Goodman Orchestra, you know, that whole record just blew my mind. You know, Gene Krupa playing drums on it. I wanted to be Gene Krupa when I was a kid.
I think we all did.
I mean, yeah. My dad listened to Ray Charles and, like I said, Count Basie, Fats Waller, Bunk Johnson, Henry Red Allen, Louis Armstrong. So that stuff fascinates me. To move this ahead, you know, I grew up in that time when my brother and sister, they were bringing home Paul Butterfield. My mm-hmm. sister brought me home a Little Walter record, and that was it. Once I heard Little Walter, then I was off into Sail On, Muddy Waters, Little Walter, Hate to See You Go. They brought home Junior Wells and Buddy Guy, Hoodoo Man Blues, you know, and they were in college, you know, so
right.
It was right there for me. And yes, all of this music is what I grew up on. It's the only thing I know.
Well,
and about, you know, Truth Be Told, check this out. So I had a popular band. I was in a popular band in Eugene, and the University of Oregon Cultural Forum was run by a woman named Sue Norquist. She was a very hip young lady. And she calls me up and says, Curtis, do you mind if Clifton Chenier stays at your house? Clifton Chenier. And this is 1970, you know.
Wow.
And like, this is 1977, 76, 77. And I lived with the bass player for Robert Cray. We had a bachelor pad. And she goes, can Clifton Chenier stay at your house? So he stayed there and cooked for the band. And the band was like, in that band was Stanley Durrell. Buckwheat Zydeco.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you imagine Buckwheat and Clifton Chenier in the same band? You
know? No.
Robert St. Judy on drums. So I had the Arhooly records of Clifton Chenier, but they were nothing like seeing them live. I freaked. The G-forces that band put out, they never took a break. It was just like Zydeco. They drove the college kids crazy. I mean, and we were, you know, I didn't go to college, but I'm that age. Man, Clifton Chenier toured up for 4 days. And they stayed at our apartment for like 5 days. So that was my first introduction to Zydeco live by the King of Zydeco. So I was very lucky, man.
Oh, definitely.
So, yeah. So my whole thing basically is this is, when I stepped into this, I went, I'm going to make a rock and roll record. And my kind of rock and roll. Now, I realize Damage Control has got that kind of, you know, Horace Silver, Dr. John kind of feel to it. But that's, yeah. I mean, when Michael started playing that, it's like, I've heard Dr. John. My sister brought home the Gree Gree record when I was, like, you know, when that first came out. So I was, like, in junior high, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that record?
Yes. You know, oh, definitely.
With Walk on Gilded Splinters.
Yep.
That blew my mind when I first heard that. So I was in the right petri dish, you know.
I remember hearing that song when Humble Pie did it, and then I went back and I listened to Dr. John, and what a song Gilded Splinters is. Just an amazing tune.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is Dr. John, when I read the back, you know, this is the time when you're reading the back of the covers of the records that has all the liner notes. And that's the first time I saw the words Professor Longhair.
Hmm.
And was on the back of that album. We had a blues discography, a friend and I named Bill Rhodes. You folks out there don't know him, but here he's a music collector, a musicologist. And we looked up Professor Longhair and the Shuffling Hungarians. And then we're off and running, man. I said, who's Professor Longhair? And then you hear him and you go, matter of fact, Dr. John was responsible for putting out and helped putting out Atlantic Records, you know, Dr. John, the New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
That first Atlantic record of all those classics of him. I mean, that freaked me out. And I'm just really into this music, man. I want everybody to know about it. And I'm really into the history of it.
And speaking of history, you have a lot yourself. I mean, I'm going back and remembering you were in Room Full of Blues, correct? That was before the Alligator years. That was early on in your career. You sang for a while with Carlos Santana. You have a great story that I definitely want to hear about with John Belushi in just a bit. But let's play the song we were just referencing. It's a great song. It's got a Zydeco groove to it, which I guess we can say is a debt to Clifton and to Buckwheat. This is Truth Be Told, Curtis Salgado off Damage Control. We'll be back with Curtis to talk some more and hear a room full of great stories. It's coming up on Midwest Beat. Stay with us.
Well, the sun is out. Sky is bright, but I can't wait for the evening's night.
My love, I'm gonna oh, oh. 'Cause I love her, she loves me. That's the way it's supposed to be. We'll make it up as we go. Oh, if the truth be told,
I never knew, 'cause it's all so new. Now there's only one thing left to do.
Just let the cards unfold. Oh,
my love is pure and my heart is true, and I want to spend my life with you till two of us grow old. Oh, oh, oh.
took control. I can't believe that upon a time I found a woman who knows my mind. She brought me in from the cold. Oh, she gave me her heart, sealed with a kiss. I'm so lucky to live like this.
A love as good as gold. Oh, gold. If truth be told.
I can't believe that for all this time I found a woman who knows my mind. She brought me in from the cold. Oh, oh.
She gave me her heart, sealed with a kiss. I'm so lucky to live like this.
A love as good as gold.
Completely different style from what we heard on the title track just a few minutes ago. That, of course, my guest, Curtis Salgado off Damage Control, and that one sounds like it's fresh out of Lafayette, Louisiana. Tell me about your squeeze box player in there. He's got some chops, too.
Oh, man, that is Wayne Toup. I was on the Delbert McClinton Sandy Beach Cruise, and is what they're called, I think, and so there's all these, the Mavericks are on there, and Leroy Parnell, and all these great people, and Wayne Toups is on there, and I knew of him, but I never saw it. And, you know, I know Chubby Carrier and all this. I've seen lots of Zydeco by now, and but I saw Wayne Toups, my jaw dropped. He was so ferocious, and he's one of the finest squeeze box players, and he's a Grammy winner, but he is something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, my God. So I sat in with a band on there, and Wayne Toups came up to me on the boat one day, you know, a few days later, and said, you know, hey, man, I really enjoyed you. Who are you? And I said, I saw, you know, I was like, oh, my God. And so a few other days went by. It's a week on there, and I sheepishly walked up to him. I don't know if that's a word. And I walked up to him and said, you know, would you be willing to play on a record if I had a song for us? And would you be able to play on my record? I was nervous. And he said, sure. He's the nicest person. And so I did the band in Nashville with, you know, Kevin McHenry at his studio, who is, you know, and George Martinelli and, Tommy McDonald, I think, is on bass. And, Jack Bruno on drums, Kevin McHenry, and I did a basic track with them, and then I flew to Lafayette and had Wayne Toups play and sing on it with me, and we knocked it out of the park. I'm very happy with that. And
so he actually recorded his part in Lafayette.
Yes, he did.
Wow. Okay, that's very cool. That adds a little extra color to that song. I love that because that's the birth of that sound.
Yeah, well, you have to. I mean, that's the real deal. He's a Cajun 100%. I mean, he's like, I mean, the story is amazing. So I flew into Lafayette, and we did the session there. And
wow.
But, you know, the band's in Nashville. Then I just took the tape into at the studios called Dockside Studios, right there in Lafayette. It's a legendary studio. All sorts of people like Leon Russell and B.B. King and all these people play there. And so I got to me, it was a big deal just being at the studio. And then Wayne just laid it out. We sang it, and he laid it out. I was happy.
Wow.
So, yeah, he's brilliant. And his band, by the way, is Crack. Just this Crack-type band, man. They are tight. And he's one of the best Zydeco acts you could see.
You've been with Alligator now. This is your fourth album for Alligator. Bruce is a legend, and just the passion that he has as a blues fan comes through. It's refreshing to see a label where all the staff are fans first, and you've got a good home there. Why is Alligator your home? I mean, you spent a lot of time with other labels over the years. What brought you to Alligator? Was it the fact that Roomful of Blues was signed to that label prior to your part in it? Or after your part in it, rather?
Well, you know, they've been something for a long time. I've been collecting records and listening to this music a long time, and they came out in 1970.
Right.
And with Hound Dog Taylor. And then the next record, I wasn't interested in that one. And I was always buying the Vanguard stuff and the Chess records and stuff. But then he put out the Walter Horton. I'm a harmonica player. So Walter Horton with Carrie Bell, and he put out that record, and that's when I took notice, like, who are these guys? Now, this, of course, Alligator grows, but their reputation is basically Bruce is hands-on, and he's on it, and he's on it. He's not trying to, it's like he makes sure he has taken care of everybody, and he is truly a blues, you know, he helps people out. I mean, some of the greatest acts, some of those guys, man, like Walter Horton, or what, he bought their funeral, man. He made sure they had headstones and stuff. And a lot of those cats aren't around anymore.
Right.
And, you know, Bruce has helped. He is the old. They are the oldest, what would you call it, independent record company in the world. The United States.
And one of the biggest.
And they have a reputation. So you want, the point I'm making is like, by the time I got on to Alligator, check this out. When I was with Robert Cray, Iglar passed on it. He actually flew to Spokane, Washington to see the Robert Cray band. And he passed on us because he thought we were too slick, you know. So he made a mistake there. Robert Cray is something to behold. I mean, right. Robert Cray went on to make 5 Grammys. But here I am now on Alligator Records, and I couldn't. It's perfect for what I do. I mean, they support you. And that's, instead of this huge corporate thing or whatever, which, of course, I'd love that and all, you know, it'd be great to be on Sony Records. But then again, look what the competition you got, you know.
Right.
You know, I got to compete with Taylor Swift. I can't do that.
Yeah, you get lost in the shuffle.
I get lost in the shuffle. You know what I mean? And I'm not a pop star. So this is what I do, and they're perfect for me, you know? And I couldn't be happier. Look, you know, this record isn't really a blues record.
Right.
And they're open, and he's open to this. You know, he's like, okay, I dig the record. And the staff likes it, and the staff's incredible. So, you know, it's just, they're like a family. And for me and what I do, what I grew up on, allowing me to be me, this is perfect. I'm very happy.
Now, coming from Eugene, Oregon, obviously you got your musical influences from your siblings. Is Eugene, or is Oregon in general, a blues place? I never thought of that as a blues hub.
Well, I understand that, but you have to understand that Portland is a port town. Seattle is a port town. Tacoma is a port town. Port City. And so lots of stuff. Portland's got a pretty, Oregon is, Portland, Oregon, for instance, has got a heavy reputation. I mean, they used to have Shanghai people in the 1800s from the bars on the porch of, you know, they had quite a heavy nightlife. And get this, I mean, Charlie Parker played here. Dizzy Gillespie, Count Basie. Louis Armstrong used to love getting food here from a famous red beans and rice and gumbo restaurant here in Oregon. That's because, and the answer is, these people travel, man. You know, all those bands in the 30s and 40s, they came through here. All the vaudeville acts came through Oregon. They came through Portland, Oregon, and they went up to Tacoma, and they went up to Seattle. Ray Charles spent years in Seattle. He did a stint, not just a few years, but he was up. That's where he met Quincy Jones. The history in Oregon and in the Northwest, everybody thinks it's cowboys and Indians.
Right.
And it is. It's lumber, but it's a port city. So you've got a lot of action going on, illegal and legal, you know. And so, you know, prohibition was heavy here.
Right.
And speakeasies were heavy here. And same up in Seattle, same in Tacoma and Olympia. Yeah, there is a red hot history here that people don't realize.
Well, someone go ahead.
You know, I saw Count Basie when I was 13, like I said here. I mean, they all came through. Everybody came through.
And we mentioned Robert Cray, and it's interesting because he is not from there, but he lived there for a while. Is that where you guys met in the 70s when he was in Oregon?
Yeah, he moved, he's from Washington. He's from the Northwest.
Okay.
His father was Army and actually a high-ranking officer, but Robert was, like, I think, born in Germany, so they call him an Army brat. But there's Fort Lewis up there in Tacoma and Seattle. And Robert and Richard Cousins are from Tacoma, Washington, and they moved down to Eugene, Oregon, which is a University of Oregon / lumber town. It's a lumber university town.
So,
Ken Kesey, the Grateful Dead, they were here all the time. I mean, they... I don't know if you ever heard of Ken Kesey, the author.
Yeah, I got a signed copy of his Cuckoo's Nest in my office.
Right. Well, this is where he wrote it. This is Ken Kesey's lived here in Pleasant, what's it called, Pleasantville or whatever? It's just outside of Eugene, Oregon. Ken Kesey used to sit on my stage. Him and Timothy Leary used to come and see me play. And one night they both sat in a chair next to me. Up on stage. I don't know why I'm telling you this, but it was like a blue collar hippie town.
Wow.
But everybody came through, man. We had like Jeff Lorber Jazz Fusion playing up here. We had Robert Cray and Richard and his band. They moved down here in 75 into Robert's from Tacoma, Washington. So they moved down to Eugene, Oregon.
You spent some time with him. You also spent some time with Carlos Santana for about a year, year and a half, 86, 87-ish, correct?
Yeah. Well, let me back up a little.
Okay.
I was with Robert. Robert moved to Eugene in 75.
We're
still friends. And I don't see a lot of him. You know, he's got a kid he's raising. I think he lives in Santa Barbara. But, you know, we get older, you kind of like, connection kind of goes. But I was with Robert in his band for like 7 years, and then we've been playing before that. So from 1975 to 1982, we were playing music together. And then with Santana, I made a record called More Than You Can Chew on a label called Rhythm Safari. And the guy's name was Hilton Rosenthal III, and he was into a world beat music guy that he launched named Johnny Clegg.
Oh, yeah, and Savuka. Savuka. I love Johnny Clegg.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was the first world beat music I'd heard.
Yeah, he's from Africa. I can't remember what part.
Yeah, he's from South Africa, I do believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, speaks French and speaks various tribal languages. Incredible talent. Anyhow, the guy who discovered him and pushed him heard a demo tape of me and did a record called More Than You Can Chew. And this record ended up through Robert Cray's manager named Mike Kappas. He managed Robert Cray, and he actually had an agency called Rosebud Agency, who handled John Lee Hooker, Robert Cray, George Thorogood, the Meters, the Neville Brothers, like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Mike Kappas and I knew each other, and he was, I will call him a friend and a fan, and he handed Carlos Santana my record that I had put out called More Than You Can Chew. And a very good record, I think. Nobody knows of it. And the guy, Hilton Rosenthal, put the record. He found me. We made this record, blah, blah, blah. It ended up in the hands of Carlos Santana. And Carlos auditioned me and took me on the road for a tour. The tour was only like 6-7 weeks long. And it wasn't for me. I wasn't anything against Carlos, but it's not really. I felt like I should be wearing, you know, puffy sleeves and a banana hat or something because, you know, I'm doing Oyo Como Vaughn stuff. And the rule was that I should be doing, he was going, Curtis, we'll do some of your songs on your new record. And we didn't do any of the songs. Mm. We only did one time. And then secondly, it wasn't really for me. It wasn't, I needed to be out on my own. All love towards Carlos Santana, and but it just wasn't my wheelhouse, man. And I wasn't having fun, and I didn't really want to be there. I'm glad I got it on my resume.
Right.
And I did learn a lot, and I met the finest musicians, you know. I mean, my God, Chester Thompson and Myron Dove and Carlos Santana and the drummers, it was Carl Perezzo and Raul, I can't remember his last name, but the Conga, those guys are monsters. Mm-hmm. You know, Billy Johnson on drums, who used to be with Marvin Gaye. So I'm in this band, but I wasn't happy. And I think Carlos could feel it. And secondly, we weren't promoting the record that I was told we were going to promote.
Right.
You know, I mean, he's got to do his thing, but I was told that,
you get to do yours too.
I get to do mine too.
Yeah.
That didn't work out. And you know,
well,
didn't even touch on it.
Let's,
like, I need to go home now.
let's spotlight another song from here. What would you like to play?
You're going to miss my sorry ass.
Okay. That's number 3 on here. We're going to play it. Again, this is new music from Curtis Salgado. Damage Control is the album on Alligator Records. It is now officially out, and we'll talk to Curtis on the other side.
Treasure down to the trash. We'll find trouble, you'll get angry with me, crying how I
the best time he ever had. Oh yeah, I don't expect no apologies. I got none to give. I showed you how to walk the razor's edge and a chance to finally live. What's so bad about doing wrong? My saying sorry won't change the past. When you look on back and think of me, you're gonna miss my sorry ass. Yeah, when I'm dead and gone and I'm buried, oh yeah, buried 6 feet down in the cold, cold ground, I know you won't think of me from the past.
Kevin McKendry on the Ivories there. Love the piano on that song. That is new music. Once again, Curtis Salgado. Damage Control is the album. And again, a different sound from what we've already heard. And you're going to have that throughout this album. All these tracks that you're going to hear, or well, that you will hear when you get the album, 13 of them in all have a different groove to them, a different flavor, a different spice, if you will, and makes for a great, great record. Curtis Salgado is my guest. Curtis, I got to ask you, and I'm hoping you say yes, is this available on vinyl? I have a couple of vinyl record stores. I'm a vinyl junkie, and I love to play that that black wax, and I'm just hoping that you got this out there.
It hasn't been brought up by Alligator, and I wouldn't even know the first step of how to do it. You know, that's an Alligator question.
Mm.
But, you know, I know a lot of people are doing that, and basically, to me, what thinking in my head is like, you know, that was probably a little more expensive because, you know, it's made out of plastic.
Right.
And, you know, that's a whole different thing. Digital, of course, is, you know, let me add to that, Tom, if you don't.
Sure.
When I first made a record, my very first album that I did was with Robert Cray. I did a record with Robert. I was on Robert's record, I mean. And that was vinyl. And I thought everything was going to be vinyl. And when I put out my first solo record, it was a CD, and I was so disappointed. It's like, what's this? And now CDs are going away.
Yeah, they are.
So, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, it's a one-off kind of like a souvenir. You make because it's not cost-effective to make albums anymore, really. If everybody and their dog was buying it, I'd probably be doing it, but...
It's getting like that. It's getting like that. We're seeing the rise in the vinyl sales, and they're outselling CDs, at least in my stores, about 3-1.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's a boom.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know what to say. I would love it in vinyl. I would just be thrilled.
Maybe we'll have to twist some arms over there and see what we can do. I do need to have you touch on this story because of the fact that we are in the Chicago market. A lot of people probably don't realize, but when you see the Blues Brothers, Jake and Elwood, Dan and John, we see them in these characters that they became for so many years. And you actually had a hand in helping create Joliet Jake Blues and the Blues Brothers. Tell us how you and John met up and what your fingerprints are on his character.
All right. So I'll be real. I'm no problem in talking about this at all. I am part of something that became iconic. It is true. And here's what happened. I lived with a member of the Robert Cray Band, a cat by the name of Richard Cousins. And you'll see why I'm going here.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get why. You have to be patient. Richard came up to me one night in the apartment. He goes, you know, Robert's got a part in a movie, I guess, that's being played here. We're living in Eugene. He goes, Robert's got a part in a movie. I go, really? And that was about it. It's like, huh, I'll be darned. That's it. About 3 weeks later, you know, so somebody's making a movie and Robert got a part in it. Robert Craig. End of story. About 3 weeks later, we're doing a double, what I would call a review show. It'll be the Nighthawks, a band I'm in, and mm-hmm. the Robert Cray band. And we're playing at the Eugene Hotel, which is obviously a hotel in Eugene. And we've got the ballroom booked out for us, both bands, to play on a Friday and Saturday. And on Saturday night, this guy comes up to me as I'm on stage and says, hey, Bellucci wants to meet you. And this is, by the way, a review show. You know, Robert's going to play one set. I'm going to play another set. And then we're going to play together, both bands together.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing my set. And this guy goes, Bellucci wants to meet you. I know who this guy is because he's the one of the local cocaine dealers in Eugene. And he goes, hey, Curtis Bellucci wants to meet you. I have no idea what he's talking about. And here's the important part is, Richard and I don't own a television. We own a stereo. And secondly, we're not home on Saturday night.
Right.
We worked Saturday night. So we had no idea of Saturday Night Live. We don't watch television. We don't have one. And we know nothing about John Bellucci. And so what happens is Bellucci wants to meet you, Bellucci. And I told the guy in no short terms to buzz off, if you catch my drift. And then I jumped off the stage at the end of my set, and I'm walking towards a group of girls who I know. And this guy grabs me. His name is, we call him Little Dick because his name is Richard, but he's about 5'1".
Mm-hmm.
So Little Dick grabs me, spins me around, and goes, Bellucci. And he holds out his arm, like, ta-da. And John comes up to me and shakes my hand, goes, hey, man, I like what you're doing. I like your music. Thank you very much. I'm thinking, I don't know who this guy is at all. And he goes, you remind me of a friend of mine. His name is Dan Aykroyd. You kind of look like him, too. And he plays harmonica. And I thought, who gives a poop?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, every hippie in town plays harmonica. And I don't know who he's talking about. And Bellucci is picking up on this because I just look at him blank, like, oh, great. Thank you. And he goes, yeah, well, I'm with this movie in town. And here's why I told you about Richard. I go, oh, yeah, Robert's in that movie. And that was my first word.
Uh-huh.
He goes, yeah, I'm with this movie. Yeah, Robert's in that movie. He goes, I saw Robert today. He taught us how to dance. And I thought to myself, well, of course. Yeah, because we danced on stage when we played together. So I go, oh, you know, and so it's getting down. The conversation is about to go. And John goes, you know, I'm with this movie, and I'm really working hard. I have to fly from New York City to Portland, or down here to Eugene. Eugene is about 2 hours away from Portland, south of Portland. So he has to fly from New York, go to Portland, get in a car, and drive to Eugene to do work on the movie. And he goes, man, it's grueling. And then tomorrow morning, I got to go back and then fly back to New York. And then Monday, you know, I got a lot of work, but he goes like this. He goes, but man, I'm really looking forward to it. And I think he knew this would get me. He goes, because we're going to do a show with Ray Charles. It's going to be on the show. Ray Charles is going to, I go, what? He goes, yeah, Ray Charles is going to be with us on the show. What did you just say? And my first words were like, you got to ask Ray Charles about Guitar Slim. And he goes, who's Guitar Slim? And I go, you don't know Guitar Slim? And I just pounced on him, man. I just like, well, Guitar Slim, I mean, Ray Charles plays piano on him. Matter of fact, he ran the session. And that's like one of the greatest R&B songs, blues songs of all time. Let's see, it's 1953, Specialty Records, Ray Charles, blah, blah, blah. I tell him, you know, Guitar Slim, the things I used to do. And he's going, really, really? And I said, did you know Ray Charles plays alto saxophone? He goes, he plays alto sax? And then I do my, you know, just like you. I mean, I go like, yeah, he plays alto sax. It's on Hot Rod, Newport Jazz Hot Rod, 1958, live at Newport, Ray Charles. and he plays on the song Hot Rod. I'm sorry I had to get that. But that's it. I said, yeah, Newport Jazz on Atlantic Records, man. Hot Rod, you got to check this out. He's looking at me, and I'm just going through history. This boom, that's who I am.
Hmm.
He goes, let's smoke a joint. Let's go smoke a joint. So we go smoke a joint. And we're talking, and I just, you know, we're shooting this shit and all this kind of stuff. The night ends, blah, blah, blah. About 5 days later, 4 or 5 days later, he calls me up and says, Curtis, my wife is cooking dinner, and we'd like to invite you over, and would you bring the records over? And so, because so here's the issue. His wife was Judy Jacklin, and we're still friends to this day. And a matter of fact, Jim Belucci lives down in Southern Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a marijuana farm down there.
Of course he does.
I know Jim, and I've met Aykroyd over the years. But what happened was that John told me, he goes, you know, my friend Dan, I told you about him, he has been trying to get me into the blues, and I wasn't into it, and he was into it now, and I brought him all these records, and I started telling him the history of who's who and what did this and that, and he goes, yeah, you know, Dan's been trying to get me into the blues. And so basically I was his muse.
Okay, and so you introduced him to the music that made him famous all over again.
Well, what do you mean by that? I mean all over again.
Well, I mean John was already famous for comedy.
Yeah, Saturday Night.
And then you made him a blues artist that made him all over again. So he's got fans on both ends.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Because we knew John here, of course, being in Second City.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, Second City, of course, yeah. And Aykroyd, well, check this. Aykroyd was already into the blues because John told me this as well. He says, you know, Dan's already into it. And Dan was into a band called the Down Child Blues Band out of
Canada. Yeah, they worked with Spencer Davis. I remember that.
Right.
I booked them for a while.
Wow.
Way back in the day.
Well, I am honored. So anyhow, so Dan, in that band, the Down Child Blues Band, two members of the band are brothers. And so he had this idea, and Belucci told me that. He says, you know, Dan's got this idea, and basically it was a skit. And they did the skit on Saturday Night Live, and they even mentioned my name, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
So thanks to Curtis Salgado. By that point, my band that I was in didn't want to make a career of music, but Robert did, and Richard, and they invited me to join the band. So there were two front men in the Robert Cray band, and when Robert put out his first record, they weren't interested in the band. They were just interested in Robert, and naturally they should be. He was, you know, young, gifted, and black, and represented the future of the blues. And I'd like to say on behalf of Robert that he was fully realized even back then. When I met him in 75, he was like sang just as good back then as he does now.
Right.
And he just didn't miss. You know,
right.
He was a natural, and you know,
that's...
I'll never. Yeah. So back with John Belushi and stuff. I mean, we became friends. I gave him a bit about you're gonna make like a camel and walk a mile, and make like Chesterfield and satisfy. Depends on what you're packing, regular or king size.
Right.
So he whipped out his gym. That whole bit, I gave him over the telephone. He literally would call me up. He told me about hiring Steve Cropper, Donald Duck Dunn,
mm-hmm.
and Matt Guitar Murphy. He called me up to tell me and ask me what I thought about it. What do you mean? What do I think about
that's
it?
That's awesome. Yeah.
I thought, you know, hey,
wow.
What do you think of that? Yeah, yeah. So we became close, and I was his muse.
Mm-hmm.
And he would check on me, like, if I agreed or disagreed, or would he knew that I would. Are you kidding me, Donald Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper? You know?
Wow.
So, and then I was told also that they, you know, Aykroyd wrote a lot of script. He wrote the Blues Brothers movie. And I heard that they had written the Robert Cray band in the script. But, you know, but they, hey, man, they got Walter Horton in it and John Lee Hooker. You can't beat that, you know.
Right. Well, Curtis.
And I played a part in launching I'm very proud of that. But
we are running out of time. I'm hearing your music coming in underneath me. It has been a pleasure. I would love to get you back on the show again.
Anytime, sir. Sorry if I overtalked.
Not a problem. That's a great story. Thank you. Curtis Salgado has been my guest on Midwest Beat. Stay with us. Here's a final track from him, and we're heading into your headlines shortly.
Call you, dear friend, but behind your back, they're whispering the fix is in. Well, the fix is in. Now, wait a minute. Remember the crash 2008 and your 401k? It's the number on your pay stub that you file away. It's the golden ticket that's just a tease that you'll retire to a life of ease. But those dreams that vanish from crooked business dealings, white collar crime, greed, and corporate stealing. Not one CEO responsible did time in the pen, 'cause they're the one percenters, Americans.